Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme is, what has happened to liberal media? Many of us have been involved in it. We have published with it or broadcast through it. But it's morphed into something different today. Now, we know about the right media, and we know what their agendas are. We know how they propagandize. We know who the characters are. But there's always been this idea that the left is not going to be as compromised. The left will be more honest, will look at issues with a more, let's say, straight vision. They will not allow themselves to be influenced by special interest groups. And indeed, at one time, Ramparts, Mother Jones, the Covert Action Quarterly, The Nation magazine, there were many Atlantic, Harper's, all these would allow voices that challenged authority. As long as you could document your case, you had a forum. Today, that is not necessarily the case. In fact, in some cases today, if you represent true liberal or humanistic or spiritual views, you're excluded from all media, including much of the alternative media. How did this happen? What went wrong? What can we learn from this? And what is a viable progressive media in the post-truth world? My first guest today is Chris Hedges. He is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activist, as well as a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He is also a Presbyterian minister and a visiting Princeton University lecturer, and for almost two decades was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America and the Middle East and Africa and the Balkans, reporting for the New York Times and other outlets. And while at the Times, he received the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. That same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Now, Chris has authored many best-selling books. His most recent is America, The Farewell Tour, which is a deep on-the-ground account of America's accelerating economic and social and political decay and the nation's descent into fascism. Chris also hosts the weekly TV program On Contact, with interviews with prominent dissidents, and it's ignored by the mainstream media. It airs every Saturday on Russian TV or RTV.com. One of my largest concerns today is that when I looked at the actual statistics of how many people identify not just as a Democrat or a Republican, conservative or liberal, but how closely they're aligned with the platforms and policies of either side. And together, it's about 19 million and 24 million. But the independents, who all of whom at one time belonged to the Democratic Republicans, now number over 105 million. Now, you would think with a lot of those being progressive-minded and not wanting to be a part of the lesser of two evils, that we would have had a more viable set of platforms and multiple candidates. And even when we do have some good candidates, Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, they get generally a 1% more or less. And yet they do have some media, certainly not in the debates, not what the mainstream media has given the other candidates who are Democrat or Republican. But then when you speak with people and you think, look at all the issues that we could be addressing and should be, like global warming, not just with pontification and euphemisms that Obama would give and let's have another meeting and another series of roundabouts around the world, but actually do something. It never happens. Universal health care doesn't happen. Closing down military bases doesn't happen. Lessening the military-industrial complex budget does not happen. Helping people who are at the lower end of the economic and social scale to have a quality of life doesn't happen. Feeding the hungry doesn't happen. Stopping wars doesn't happen. So I'm thinking, wow, of at least 40 important issues that could be addressed by the Democrats and Republicans and the media they represent, I rarely, if ever, see this discussed, including the left not taking on the human disaster in Yemen with 22 million people severely affected, It is now estimated over 100,000 children have died of starvation, largest cholera epidemic in the world, and yet only when they can attack Trump do they even mention Yemen. But they had no problem having over 450 interviews on MSNBC alone with Stormy Daniels and her attorney. Something has gone terribly wrong with the left and the media. Could you give us your insights, please?
Well, let's begin with the electronic commercial media, because the electronic commercial media has now completely abandoned, and I include MSNBC, any commitment to journalism. It is all about revenue streams. Now, of course, these news programs are part of large corporations. Viacom, Comcast owns MSNBC. They compete with other revenue streams, and they are judged not by their ability to do journalism or cover news, but by the ability to bring in profit. And if they can't bring in profit, then the people who run that news division are replaced. CNN has become utterly shameless in perpetuating the reality television show that has become part of our political discourse. Giving platforms to people who should not have any public platform, bigots, and solely so they can argue with Van Jones or other quote-unquote liberals. And so I think that the electronic commercial media has decided that info entertainment takes precedence over journalism. They don't report the reality of the majority of Americans. Over half of this country now lives in poverty or near poverty, something you've worked pretty hard to document. And they're erased from the national debate. And I think that's part of the reason that the national press has such low credibility with the public, because they've rendered most of the public invisible to function as courtiers, reporting and discussing and arguing about court gossip. Stormy Daniels is the most egregious example of this, but it happens every single day, often revolving around the vulgar and ridiculous tweets that are put out by the president. So at the same time, we have seen print-based media, which I come out of, in severe decline because the monopoly that the print-based media once had connecting sellers with buyers has been destroyed by the internet. We first saw the major assault on newsprint take place with classified advertising, and 40% of newsprint's revenue came from classified advertising. So as soon as Craigslist and these other sites came up, almost 50% of the revenue was wiped out. Now, because of the sophisticated algorithms and profiling that we have allowed corporations like Google and Facebook to carry out, newsprint is an outdated vehicle. People can, or advertisers or sellers can use profiles to target potential buyers directly on the internet. They don't need newsprint. So there's been a withering away of the traditional journalism, and I don't want to in any way, and I worked for the New York Times for 15 years, I don't want in any way to minimize the elitism of that journalism. I've often said that the unwritten motto of the New York Times is do not significantly alienate those on whom we depend for access and money. You could alienate them once in a while, but you certainly couldn't make a habit of it. And thirdly, and this is perhaps the most important loss that we had a diverse press. We had alternative media, the Village Voice, but all cities had alternative, most cities had alternative newspapers. They didn't make a lot of money. We had in the 60s and early 70s magazines like Ramparts, and they kept the traditional media honest by embarrassing it Ramparts, which was run by Robert Scheer, who now runs the website I write for, Truthdig. He did the first work on COINTELPRO. It was Ramparts that published the iconic photo of the young Vietnamese girl running naked down a road being burned by napalm, a photo that led Martin Luther King to stand up on April 4th, 1967 in Riverside Church and denounce the war. And so that the traditional media, which, and the New York Times was certainly guilty of this, that at the beginning of the Vietnam War functioned as a cheerleader for the war, was embarrassed into doing their job. And this alternative media has largely evaporated. So the pressure on newsprint to do responsible journalism from the alternative media has largely vanished. Newsprint has become very anemic. If you go to cities like Philadelphia, for instance, the paper is a shadow of what it had been. I remember, 20 years ago, when all these regional papers, the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, the Dallas Morning News, which I worked for before I worked for the New York Times, they all had foreign bureaus. They had foreign sections. They had investigative teams. That's all gone. So across the media landscape, we've become immensely impoverished. The pressures on journalistic outlets to do good journalism has largely disappeared. And the commercialization of especially the electronic media has obliterated journalism on the airwaves. And let's not forget PBS, which depends on corporate donors, including the Koch brothers, which is why it's so boring and irrelevant.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you, Chris. Frequently, when people align today on issues, they align with specific politicians. Many of the young millennials, at least those who are savvy using the media to understand the larger pictures, are in support of Bernie Sanders, at least in the last election. And when I would speak with them about what part of Bernie Sanders' agenda do you support, and they supported universal health care, I said, that's good. I would agree with that. Do you support holding banks accountable? Do you support stopping the prison pipeline? And yes. I said, what about the unbridled support of Israel? No matter what it does, it cannot be challenged. Well, I wasn't aware of that. What about the support for the military-industrial complex that he has signed off on? What about all of our foreign invasions and foreign interventions and regime changes? Do you support that? Do you support keeping all these 900 military bases open? Well, they weren't aware of it. I said, well, then there's two Bernie Sanders. There's that Bernie Sanders that has some very pragmatic or progressive views on domestic issues, and that Bernie Sanders that is no different than any other person engaged in hegemony and empire building around the world. So can you take responsibility if you vote for someone for that part, or do you section that off and isolate it? And that's when generally the conversation ceases. Could you give us your perspective on the danger of assuming that the only people who should be elected to office are career politicians or people who've been in the, let's say, the swamp of Washington for so long they're a recognizable and identifiable name with some good causes, but then you start digging deeper and you see how tied they are to so many special interests versus people outside the political realm who would make far better representatives, but who the public doesn't know and hence will never be elected?
Well, let's be clear on Bernie Sanders. He is a Democrat. He presents himself as an independent, even a socialist, although you can't be a socialist unless you're an anti-imperialist. And if he is an anti-imperialist, he's certainly never made that public. He has, along with the rest of the Congress, been an uncritical supporter of Israel. During the bombing of Gaza in 2008, he voted with all other 99 senators on a resolution saying that Israel had a right to defend itself, which was utterly insane, given that the Palestinians have no army, no mechanized units, no artillery, no air force, no navy. And what was happening in Gaza was in essence, murder, a state-sponsored murder. And you're right, he won't criticize the military-industrial complex, which is hollowing the country out from the inside. Half of all discretionary spending is now goes towards a military machine that is waging feudal and endless wars in the Middle East that profit, of course, the defense contractors and no one else, certainly no one in the Middle East and not us. So Sanders is, captive to those forces that dominate the Democratic Party. Let's not forget that he campaigned for Bill Clinton, and not just the first time, but the second time, after he pushed through NAFTA, after he pushed through the omnibus crime bill that exploded our prison population. So Sanders is a compromised figure. I will say that what made Sanders unique is, ironically, like Donald Trump, is that he acknowledged the reality of social inequality in a way the Clinton campaign and the other candidates would not. So at least he acknowledged that reality. But not that he cared, but I didn't endorse him. I voted for him in the primaries, and then I voted for Jill Stein in the general election, and have not voted for a Democrat since 2000, and worked for Nader's campaign when he was running. I don't believe that the Democratic Party is an effective vehicle for reform. Indeed, it doesn't even function as a political party, in that the base has absolutely no say in terms of its policies and how it's run. It isn't going to carry out effective finance reform, campaign finance reform, because these figures like Pelosi and Schumer, their power is derived from their ability to funnel Wall Street and corporate money to the anointed candidates. And if that money was erased from the equation, figures like Schumer and Pelosi wouldn't even hold power, and they know it. And they're not about to slit their wrists politically by carrying out the kinds of reforms that could transform the Democratic Party into a viable party where the base actually had a voice in terms of its policies, its direction, and most importantly, the candidates that it nominates. So I agree with you that we have to step out into the wilderness. At first, it's very lonely and difficult, but we mustn't forget that 10 years ago, Syriza, the ruling party of Greece, was polling at 4%. We're not going to build a viable political alternative in an election cycle. And this, again, was part of the tragedy of the Sanders campaign, and when he talked about his political revolution, which was ended up being a slogan as empty as hope and change. He gathered quite a bit of money, I think over $200 million, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of organization, a lot of support. And where did it end? It ended with him traveling around the country telling us to vote for Hillary Clinton. So he missed his historical moment, as Cornel West told me, when he did not walk out of the Democratic convention in Philadelphia, where I think there's a very strong argument to be made the nomination was stolen from him by the Democratic Party elite in a variety of ways, in terms of erasing voters from the rolls, refusing independents the ability to vote in the primaries, although, of course, the taxpayers pay for the primaries, not the Democratic Party, stealing the Nevada caucus. We know, because of the Podesta emails, how the Democratic National Committee was set up roadblocks to his campaign and served as, in essence, an arm of the Clinton campaign. So I just don't see – I mean, it's clear Sanders is going to run again, although I don't think he's going to gather the kind of enthusiasm he gathered before. I think he's a very tainted figure because he's been exposed as a tool of the establishment. I mean, when Schumer has a press conference, he always trots out Sanders to stand in the background. I think he's the director of outreach or some empty position that they have given him. And he was running around the country during the midterms endorsing neoliberal corporate Democrats as somehow a solution. So, I have long believed, like Ralph Nader, that we've got to build something on the outside to pit power against power. And that's not going to happen through the Democratic Party.
My other concern is that we are so engaged in identity politics, and Michelle Obama, and I did a commentary in response to her comments that anyone who voted for Trump, any woman who voted for Trump, something's wrong with her brain, without first asking how many of those women were voting not because they liked Trump, but because of the promises made by her husband, Hillary Clinton's husband, and George Bush, that were not honored. A lot of those were unionists. A lot of those were lifelong Democrats. And yet they're all lumped together as if somehow they're all brain deranged. And then Michelle Obama said to this large audience, she said, and yet we had the perfect candidate, you know, in Hillary Clinton. And I'm thinking, what? Did anyone take a look at her own background? So when you have someone who is elected because of the color of their skin, and then they say, well, but he's a constitutional scholar, and I'm thinking, yes, and what did he do with that that helps strengthen the Constitution? What did he do that actually goes against the American citizenry? And you are very specifically involved in that because you went to jail or with threat of jail because you protested outside of the White House for his National Defense Authorization Act and sued him on that. Talk about for a moment, please, what it means when we engage in identity politics. We want a woman, but we don't look at all the women who would care for all women all over the world and not just a political party's women. And we want someone of color instead of someone who cares about all people, irrelevant of a person's color, age, or ethnicity, or race. And the dangers when we become so isolated, so specific to an identity that we don't look at anything else.
Well, I mean, obviously we want women and people of color in positions of power, but those women and people of color who are selected by the establishment to run for and assume positions of power serve the interests of the establishment, which is precisely what Barack Obama did, which is why the Chicago political machine, which is probably the dirtiest political machine in the country, selected, promoted, and pushed Obama into the Senate and into the White House. And he did, as Cornel West said, he was a black mascot for Wall Street. So this is how colonialism functions. The French or the Belgians or whoever are not ruling in places like the Congo directly. They make sure Patrice Lumumba is assassinated, and they put in the pliant and corrupt Mobutu, who does their bidding and who becomes immensely wealthy doing their bidding. And that's how colonialism functions. And that's how the political system, which is dominated by corporate power, functions. It pushes out a woman. It pushes out a person of color who is pre-selected. I mean, my favorite story that illustrates this point is I went to Harvard Divinity School, and in 1970, I wasn't there then, but there were no faculty of color, no African-American professors. And so the white hierarchy of Harvard Divinity School interviewed James Cone, you know, hands down the greatest contemporary theologian in America. They interviewed a young, fairly young, recently minted PhD candidate who had never written a book. A record that would remain unbroken once he was hired by Harvard over the next 30 years. And so, of course, they didn't give it to Cone because they couldn't deal with his brilliance. They couldn't deal with his independence. He was a threat. And so they put out a black face. They hired a professor who was extremely mediocre and pliable and would do their bidding. And we forget that these figures, like Obama, didn't just rise like Venus on a half shell from the sea. They were groomed, cultivated, vetted, and checked to make sure that they would not push against the establishment. And we saw that immediately. I think it's in Ron Suskind's book, when Obama takes power and he's talking to all these CEOs from Wall Street saying that I'm between what's you and the pitchforks, but don't worry, I've got your back. So Obama came in with a mandate at Change and Reform, and he sold us out. And so, yes, this we're being played by identity politics. And I'm all for voting for women and people of color. I voted for Jill Stein You know, they're and that's important, but it's more important, are they going to stand up and fight on behalf of the oppressed, on behalf of their constituencies, or are they part of what Glenn Ford, the editor of the Black Agenda Report, calls the Black misleadership class? And the whole idea that Hillary Clinton somehow cares about women and children after her complicity during the Clinton administration in the dismantling of the welfare program, where 70% of the original recipients were children, is appalling. You know, her own history has been one of selling out the very people she purports to care about and represent. And this has just been a whole inversion, for instance, on all sorts of ideas and movements, including feminism. Feminism is about empowering oppressed women. It is not about having Sheryl, is it Sandberg, the head of Facebook, is not about having a woman CEO or a woman president. And yet, of course, that is how the idea has been twisted and corrupted and perverted to serve the systems of power.
Last quick thought. I've been a part of Pacifica for 42 years, the longest-running non-commercial radio program in American history. I've been on the air for 52 years. I'm celebrating my 52nd year on radio. And on the one hand, I saw it in its heyday, and then I saw it decline, and then I saw many of its more popular programs become very corporatized or very ideological and supporting neoliberal views. And that was one of the last bastions of where people felt they could go to hear programming that represented the people and the environment and human rights and values that were not political but were far more intrinsic to our well-being. Have you noticed anything within Pacifica's evolution that you're concerned about?
I don't know that I listen to Pacifica broadly enough to offer a wholesale critique of Pacifica in, you know, specifically. However, clearly neoliberal ideology, identity politics, the smokescreen that somehow Russia stole our elections, which is just a subterfuge so that we don't look at the grotesque income inequality that was the real reason that propelled Trump into the White House, has infected the left quite a bit. I mean, I've been very involved in the last few days ringing the alarm bells about Julian Assange, who is about to be evicted, it appears, from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and the stunning silence on the part of journalists, including journalists on the left, for what will set a legal precedent, which is the ability of the state to imprison publishers. Because Assange did not, he published these documents, but he didn't leak them. They were leaked to him. I would say that this is, you know, many, the cant and the propaganda that we are just bombarded with, courtesy of handheld devices, has become so powerful that it has debilitated not only most of the public, but I would argue the left as well. And we see it on a variety of issues, including, of course, every presidential election cycle, when the left, which says that it supports the Palestinians and opposes the military-industrial complex and the crimes of empire and cares about our imprisoned population, and falls to its knees and removes its spine and stands for nothing. And the Democratic Party knows it, which is why every election cycle things get worse and worse and worse. So it's broader than Pacifica. It's a left that won't fight for anything and won't stand for anything, and therefore has become irrelevant.
I appreciate your insights. Chris, thank you very much for being with us. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris Hedges. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme is what happened to liberal media. At one time, it stood firm. It stood on principle. It was not corporate influenced or backed. And yet today, across the full spectrum, the liberal media is in retreat. It has abrogated its responsibility more often than not. Look at MSNBC. And look at The Nation magazine. The Nation still does some good articles, but does not take on the really strong causes it once did. The Village Voice is out of business, and though there is a resuscitation in Covert Action Quarterly, publication I really appreciated. Our next guest was a part of this media, and still is. Her name is Eutrice Leed. Eutrice is a Trinidadian-American civil rights activist and journalist. She co-founded the City Sun, a weekly newspaper that covered issues of interest to African Americans in New York City. In 1993, she started working on WBAI, where she hosted a talk radio program called Talkback. Eutrice is currently the host of Lead Stories, heard every day, Monday to Friday at 1 p.m. following my program on the Progressive Radio Network. Nice to have you with us today, Eutrice.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be with you.
Eutrice, you come from a liberal background and for over 30 years have been engaged in the political media arena. Now, both of us have witnessed enormous changes in the news industry over the years. I'm mostly interested in the liberal or left media and now the progressive media, which fights for ideals and the truth, not for identity. What have you observed has fundamentally changed in liberal interpretations and commentary on news and events, and especially on forms for whistleblowers or people that would not have an opportunity to tell their stories in any other form?
Well, for one thing, I think people in alternative media, the left media or progressive media or whatever we choose to call it, have, for the most part, acceded to the temptations of the general media. That is, they want recognition, they want stardom, they want to be in circles of perceived power and influence, and they want to be the flip side, really, of the group that they so detest. It used to be the case, and I could, you know, rattle off the names of quite a few colleagues and people who were truly dedicated to journalism, not the idea of journalism or what journalism can do to land me in, you know, special circles where I'm adored and people love me and I get to attend the right parties and that kind of thing. It is amazing how many folks in the left really have fallen victim to this temptation to want to belong. And they grow increasingly disdainful, in a way, of where they are. They don't like where they are. They don't like the idea of being of service, the way traditionally we understand ourselves to be of service, which is championing the people who are trodden, downtrodden, looking to confront governmental policies that really do not lift up the people but oppress them. These ideals are hard to find now in the media generally, but more painfully so in, I would say, the progressive or left media. People want adulation. They want cushy jobs. They want to be venerated, and they want an easy life. I think they've gotten tired of struggle and want an easy way out now.
Back in the 1960s, there was the marvelous political and literary journal of the New Left political movement called Ramparts. It stopped publication in 1975, but it was intelligent, sophisticated. It gave strong and credible substance to the New Left. Then there were publications such as Mother Jones, The Atlantic, Harper's, The New Yorker, and The Nation, which one time could be relied upon to give an independent perspective on news or publish altogether different stories that the mainstream media wouldn't touch. But this has all changed. They have become fully aligned with the Democratic Party, and therefore rarely can we read independent analysis critical of the mainstream left. What does this indicate about the direction of the liberal media?
Well, it's a complex question because it necessitates an analysis of how the liberal, or what we used to call the liberal media, has behaved. It has not had a very good history of good behavior. It didn't treat its employees well. It didn't pay them well. In some cases, it didn't pay them at all. It did not pay attention to the business of business. The Village Voice should not be out of business now, but it is. And there was a great resistance to these publications paying attention to the necessities. You have to have a well-run organization. There's nothing wrong about that. It is not, you know, imperialist to think of it that way. But look how much was lost because these businesses, in the end, were running on some kind of ether. It was not running on; they were not running on sound business practices. So they themselves were responsible for their own demise. You have to pay attention to the basics, so you can't deny that they are important. How are you expecting to reach people if you're not investing in circulation, building your audience, if you're not investing in the kinds of writers? A lot of these progressive organizations had zero to show for in the way of diversity. It didn't bother them that they were appealing to mostly white audiences, that they were content about reaching that small sliver, and that small sliver was their world. They did not pay attention to the fact that the world was changing and had changed around them, and they didn't bother to keep pace with what the needs of the people were. They were more obsessed with the idea of showing their intellectual properties. You know, they were really studious people. But they knew nothing of their audiences, or very little of their audiences. They showed no enthusiasm about actually being aggressive about reaching communities that need them. So progressivism in that sense was just a mild form of racism and white supremacy. I have pointed this out with regard to the Green Party. Here is a party poised to make a difference, absolutely poised to make a difference. But the Green Party is existing in a like its own little world. It's not seen in the black community or the Latino community or working class community. We don't hear them expressing the will of the people. The newspapers are exactly the same. Radio stations that purport to be speaking to these disfranchised communities are still living in a bubble. And they change in their minds. They're changing They're bringing in new faces that look like them and talk like them and are concerned with the same issues, but they're out of touch and they don't want to hear it. Yet the audience is there. The potential is there, especially in a climate like this, to be especially useful and relevant. And they're talking about issues that are relevant in their world. They don't seem to care that their world is not the world. So they've fallen prey to their own conundrum of, we will take on the burden of expressing the hurt and the dilemma and the disenfranchisement of communities. We don't have to do it ourselves, but we have the right. We have the intellectual capacity to express the will of the people, but they're not dealing with the people. They're not. Hmm. They've been told this time and again. The Democratic Party was told this time and again. And media outlets serving what they consider to be the community, they're not doing it. In New York City, we have had black stations that were the powerhouses of information going out of business. WBAI is hanging on by a thread. This is a condemnation, really, of people wasting and refusing to pay attention to how business is done and how you build audiences. You have to be aggressive about reaching out to them with the kinds of informational services that they need, not that you think they need, but that they actually need. So we see a kind of hardening of the lines where more and more progressive media outlets are just drawing harder and harder lines, although they would never admit to it, of basically ignoring great audiences out there that are available, but they're not interested in reaching them for some reason.
I would agree with that. I've seen that. Just another question here. Is there anything worth redeeming from the left liberal media? Or are we at an impasse where an entirely new direction and strategy needs to be created and undertaken to get a nonpartisan, progressive message communicated? And also, what should the shape of this new progressive media adopt in order to meet most people's needs and to empower them to be effective?
Well, they have to admit that they've blown it. They have blown it big time, especially in markets as promising, like New York, big markets, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and so forth. There are markets out there yearning for relevant coverage. And instead, we're getting, you know, that silly stuff of like the Real Housewives of Atlanta kind of stuff passing as coverage. We want real coverage. But there's a thing that I think is happening, and that is a sense of recognition within the progressive media. They will not admit, they just will not admit that they, in fact, share the blame for missing this opportunity, for blowing it. And still to this day, for refusing to reach out and say, look, what is it that we're doing wrong? Just about every progressive media organization is on the brink of, you know, going out of business. They're suffering because there's a mile's worth of difference between what they think is important and what people think is important. And they have systematically locked out, and there's no way they can deny it, they have locked out some of the best talent, some of the best opportunities for growth, and the opportunities for growth were always and still are always in communities of color. That's where the growth is. And yet for decades, they have dismissed these communities as being kind of irrelevant to the conversation. They are the conversation. But it is an odd twist on white supremacy, where people think, well, wait, we're not that kind of people. We want to control everything. Well, yes, you do. And the media is one of the best examples of how people continue to do that, but to their own peril. I don't know of any left-wing media outlet that is financially stable. And it is common sense. You have to build in a structure that allows you to support the work that you want to do. It's incomprehensible to me. I've talked to a lot of people in media, and they tell me the same thing about how they're struggling. You shouldn't be struggling. There's no reason to be struggling. You're sitting smack in the middle of one of the most lucrative, potentially lucrative markets, and you have immediate access not just to the people, but to the stories. The stories that these communities of color can tell. These are global stories. And yet we're not there. We're not telling these stories except from the point of view that, well, here is Joe Doakes, and Joe Doakes is a specialist and he's written 18 books. But does he know anything? Does he know anything about what's going on the ground in Black and Latino communities? Right now in New York City, for example, in Harlem, I can't keep pace with the number of building permits that have been issued for properties in Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant. Obviously, these historically Black neighborhoods are under direct assault of the developers and the movement to gentrify everything. The story's not being told. And it's a story that is the same. We had a fight in Chicago where Barack Obama's charity is threatening community life. So we're seeing this all over the place. But we don't see the stories being told. It is not an attractive story for some reason, for progressive media. They're not telling these stories. Maybe they're too ordinary. But this is where the fight is.
Utrice, thank you for all your participation in all these decades. And people can listen to Utrice every single day on PRN.fm at 1 o'clock or download her program on the archives. We appreciate your input, Utrice. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks a lot.
Utrice Lead. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For the final segment of our program, I'd like to share some of my own experience. I have published more than 400 original investigative reporting articles, all told over 800 articles. And some of these articles were the first of their kind in the field. For example, The Politics of Cancer, which explored, are there natural non-toxic therapies that can save lives that the medical community, especially the oncology community, is aware of, but are not allowing an opportunity. Now, this goes back to the early 1970s, and I had an opportunity to help the American Cancer Society raised funds down on Wall Street, and I was down there. In fact, I have a photograph of me out there in front of the stock exchange raising money for the Cancer Society. And then about a week later, I received a phone call from a Pat McGrady Jr. He was a highly respected journalist. He was the Newsweek's bureau chief in Moscow, and his father was the head publicist for 25 years of the American Cancer Society. And he said that his father was very determined to get a story out, and he was afraid that any of the mainstream media, including the liberal media, would not allow it to be published. And I said, what is it? He said, about, they know that there are therapies that are non-toxic, and they refuse to accept them because they're so tied into the orthodoxy and also the chemotherapies and the drugs. It's a big business. After speaking with Pat McGrady Sr., receiving hundreds of documents, reviewing them, I then contacted all the media, and every single media I contacted, including Mother Jones, who, and this is the irony, the managing editor of the Mother Jones Publications' own relative was one of the people being attacked for using natural non-toxic therapies, even though he had great success, and I had interviewed him. And she was very honest. She said, look, that could get us into litigation, and we can't afford it. Ms. Magazine, Harper's, Atlantic, I went everywhere. Nobody wanted to touch it. Why? Because, first, many didn't believe that you would engage in politics in something as serious as cancer. It was like a sacred cow. And others said that, yes, there could be, and my documentation proved it, and I had an insider whistleblower talking about this, and yet they wouldn't touch it. I finally called Steve Dunleavy at the New York Post. He came by. I showed him all the documents. I introduced him to Dr. Ralph Moss, who also worked for the American Cancer Society, and he did a headline story on it about the suppression of alternative therapies. Only after that did I get a call from a journalist from 60 Minutes, and they wanted to do a story on Dr. Lawrence Burton, and they did, and then Judy Moses, the executive producer of 2020, did a story on Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski based upon my material. But at no point did anyone within the liberal community touch it. I was very disappointed, but it, for me, it was an enlightenment moment. And then my publisher, who was probably the most liberal publisher in America, he'd come from Grove Press, a person of high ethics and standards, Dan Simon, and the founder, co-founder, with one of the relatives of the New York Times family, Phil Oakes, started Four Stories, Eight Windows, and I did their first best-selling book, The Egg Project. And now it was at Seven Stories Press, and that's where Noam Chomsky, so many well-known people within the liberal community have published. And I wanted to do a book about the right way to approach AIDS. And he thought it was a great idea, because he knew that the Tri-State Healing Center, my medical team of doctors, nurses, using my protocols, were reversing AIDS-defining illnesses in very sick men and women. And so we fully documented all these stories. And then Tony Brown at Tony Brown's Journal on Channel 13, syndicated more than 400 markets, he got a hold of the story, and he had me on with some of the cured people. At the end of this, we published a book. It was virtually a textbook. It was over 700 pages with over 3,000 scientific references. And he was so concerned about people within the liberal community, the liberal media, not accepting this information, that he hired a Professor James Feast to be the editor on all the material to verify that everything in the book was accurate. Well, the biggest chapter in the book is on natural approaches to AIDS. And nobody would review the book, not a single member of the liberal media. Why? Because, once again, it's like vaccinations, where the liberal community is pro-vaccine, and mental health, the liberal community is pro the orthodox treatment for depression and anxiety. They just refuse to look at the truth. Even with all these mass killings, they refuse to look at the truth that, yes, the guns are involved, but drugs are in 95% of the people committing these crimes, and that alters their brain, which alters their perception of reality. At the end, it was not the conservative community or the mainstream community that accepted or rejected these particular stories I was working on. It was the liberal media. They closed ranks. They refused to accept that there was a natural, non-toxic approach to AIDS. They refused to accept that there was politics involved in AIDS, and yet it was rampant with special groups aligned with the pharmaceutical company that was making his ET, getting lots of money. And then they went on an attack program to attack any doctor, scientist, no matter how credible or honest or factual, showing that we were approaching the whole subject of AIDS the wrong way, mainly the way it was being diagnosed was inaccurate, and the way it was being treated was deadly with AZT. So where was the liberal media? It was fully ensconced in the neoliberal agenda. It had been corporatized and compromised. Had someone told me that, I wouldn't have believed it. But I was there, I lived it, I saw it. And it's still true today, and that's unfortunate. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in. We look forward to sharing more. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour.